It's The Takeaway for Monday, January 22nd, 2018.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's good to have you with us today.
Under my administration, we will always defend the very first right in the Declaration of Independence, and that is the right to life.
It's President Donald Trump there speaking on Friday from the Rose Garden in the White House, addressing participants in Friday's March for Life in Washington, D.C. The march takes place every year around the anniversary of the Roe v. Wade decision that legalized abortion in all 50 states. And today marks 45 years since that ruling.
The Supreme Court today handed down a historic decision on abortion. The court said in a 7-2 decision that in the first 3 months of pregnancy, only the woman and her physician may decide whether she may have an abortion. In the second 3 months, all the state may do is regulate abortion procedures. And only in the final 3 months of pregnancy can the state forbid abortion. The court ruled in cases from Texas and Georgia, but all 50 states are effective, whatever their laws.
January 1973, the decision fell on a divided nation with abortion rights advocates rejoicing and even a little surprised.
It's very hard to believe that the men on the Supreme Court could have this much of a sense of what is really happening in abortion. You know, so many of the things that the government or the legislature or even departments of health do is so unrelated to the practice of abortion, and this is so specifically related to the practice of abortion that blows my mind.
Now, on the other side of the issue, anti-abortion rights advocates vowed to fight the ruling.
Whatever their legal rationale, seven men have made a tragic utilitarian judgment regarding who shall live and who shall die. In spite of this horrifying decision, the American people must rededicate themselves to the protection of the sacredness of all human life.
This week, we're going to take some time to look at the legal and shifting political issues at the heart of abortion and its place at the center of American political life. But first, a look back at what life was like for women who sought abortion before Roe v. Wade. Abortion was illegal in 30 states before 1973. Still, millions of women got the procedure, and some, in desperation, did so under dangerous circumstances.
I had that abortion when I was 18. It was a man I didn't love, and he loved me and he wanted to marry me, and I had left home, actually been kicked out. Of course, I came up pregnant.
That's Barbara S., who shared her story with the Abortion Diary podcast. Barbara had an abortion in the mid-1950s in Oklahoma. There were doctors in Oklahoma who would perform illegal abortions, but it had to be done secretly, and it came with great risks to both the physicians who faced prosecution and the women who risked injury and abuse.
And I asked my girlfriend if she could help me. And she gave me the number of a guy who did abortions. I didn't know anything about him. Back then, you didn't. You just took your chance. And so he told me that where to come. And I went to a house up in the northern part of Tulsa. And I walked up to this house that had the screen door was falling off. And I knocked on the door, and this guy came to the door that I didn't know if he was a fry cook, a doctor, or a plumber. I didn't know what he was or what he did. I just had a problem I had to get rid of because I was not going to live my life like my mother did. I followed him into the kitchen and climbed up on the table, and he examined me and said that I was 2 months pregnant. And that it would be $200. Well, I was just a typist. I didn't have a whole lot of money, and I certainly didn't have $200. So I left there crying, but I just was thankful I hadn't been raped, because a lot of these guys raped women whenever they did this.
Barbara, though, was still desperate to terminate her pregnancy, and she sought a different path.
So I went back home and talked to my girlfriend, and she somehow got some pills for me to take. And I took them, and I thought I had killed myself because I never had such pain in my life. It was horrible. It just kept aching and aching, but I didn't have any bleeding. Nothing came through. Finally, the pain died down by the next morning, and I was able to go to work, but in about 4 or 5 days, finally, I started having blood clots that came through. But they were just blood clots, like having a heavy period.
Barbara was still unable to terminate her pregnancy. She was in great pain. And finally, she went to see a regular doctor.
And he said, you need to get over to the hospital. I went to the hospital, and they pushed me down the hallway to the operating room. And on my chest, they had put a sign that said incomplete abortion. This was a Catholic hospital, by the way. They operated on me and saved my life because the doctor said, if I had not gone then, if I'd waited 24 hours, I would have been dead.
20 years after Barbara's experience, when the Supreme Court ruled to legalize abortion in the Roe v. Wade decision, it was in part meant to help millions of women like Barbara have access to the procedure safely in medical settings like hospitals and clinics. Today, Roe v. Wade is still the law of the land, but it's been significantly rolled back.
We've had 401 abortion restrictions enacted since January 2011. That's about one-third of the number of abortion restrictions enacted since Roe was decided in January 1973.
Elizabeth Nash is Senior State Issues Manager at the Guttmacher Institute. They're a research organization that advocates for reproductive health rights and policy in the United States. The rollbacks, she says, have made it much more difficult for women, particularly in the Midwest and the South, to access legal abortion.
The kinds of restrictions that we're talking about adding are restrictions on abortion later in pregnancy, extending waiting periods from, say, 24 hours to 72 hours, making it harder to use abortion coverage in your health plans. In fact, some states have eliminated that option. And in some states, these new restrictions have resulted in clinics closing. And so then you're talking about also much more limited access for services.
Well, across the country, overall, abortion rates are at a record low. What does that tell you?
The abortion rate has been declining since 1980. Between 2008 and 2011, we were able to find that the unintended pregnancy rate was declining. And that is in part a reason why you would see fewer abortions. But also we were seeing abortion patients and women in general using contraception, and particularly what we call long-acting methods like IUDs. That's one factor in why you're seeing a reduced abortion rate. And as we went into 2011, 12, and 13, and 14, there's no reason to think that all of that stopped. We continue to think that there are reasons people were continuing to use contraception and long-acting methods. But also, as you were getting into the 2011, 2012 range, you did start to see abortion clinics close in some states at a fairly rapid clip. And what means for those states is that you've really reduced access to abortion. So the abortion rate going down in part could be news around unintended pregnancy rates going down and access to contraception. But in other places, it means limiting access to abortion itself.
Well, as we look ahead to 2018, Elizabeth Nash, what states do you have your eye on? What legislatures or even lawsuits that might be coming up through the states that could have real national implications for access to abortion?
What we were seeing in around 2011 was that a number of state legislatures had shifted much further to the right, along with some governorships. And we saw that similarly happen in 2016 in Iowa and Kentucky. And in both of these states, we've started to see more abortion restrictions move through those state legislatures. So I would expect to see more on abortion restrictions in Iowa and Kentucky, particularly since both of those governors are very socially conservative and not supportive at all of abortion rights. As far as court cases, well, there are dozens of court cases challenging abortion restrictions, but I did kind of want to highlight a couple. One is that we've seen states adopt restrictions to ban a method used after 12 weeks of pregnancy. And we've seen 8 states enact these bans, and 6 have been challenged. The idea here is that this method is safe. It is the method used in the second trimester. And if you ban it, then you're really banning access to abortion after 14, 15 weeks. But I also wanted to highlight 2 challenges, one in Maine and one into the federal regulation of medication abortion. And the one in Maine is about challenging the state's decades-long physician-only law. And this law limits abortion provision to physicians and prohibits physician assistants or certified nurse midwives or advanced practice nurses from performing abortions. And there's lots of data to show that these kinds of advanced practice clinicians
when trained, provide equivalent services on abortion as to physicians. That would be a case to keep your eye on. Also, another case challenges the FDA, so the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's rules around medication abortion. And right now, a woman cannot go into a pharmacy and pick up a prescription for medication abortion. She has to go to a specific provider who is registered with the drug's manufacturer. This kind of barrier really limits access to medication abortion. And so there's a case coming out of Hawaii where those restrictions are being challenged. And that case was also filed in 2017. So watch for that one to move its way through the system. That one could really reshape access to medication abortion and make it much easier for women to use that method.
And Elizabeth, as we watch the states and the courts, you know, later we're going to be talking about potential challenges to Roe versus Wade in the Supreme Court if one should ever come. And a lot of people would like to bring a case like that to try to overturn Roe. Is there a state or a case or an area of abortion restriction that you're looking at that could potentially become a challenge in the Supreme Court eventually?
We could be looking at these bans on the abortion method after 12 weeks. That method is called D&E in shorthand. That could wind its way up. But what we're seeing in state legislatures right now is particularly in the states where a number of abortion restrictions have been enacted, are bills being introduced that would completely ban abortion. So not just add a waiting period or limit abortion coverage in your health plan, but ban abortion. And the point of these bills is really to instigate that challenge to Roe.
And you're saying that those states might be the places where opponents of abortion try to plant the seeds of a ban that they hope can grow into a case in front of the Supreme Court.
Exactly. With the composition of the Supreme Court as it stands, we still have the 5 votes that support abortion rights. But that could change, right? People are constantly looking at the tea leaves to see what's going on with the Supreme Court and who's going to be on it next session and who could potentially be a new member of the Supreme Court. And as we go in further into the current administration, we may see one of these 5 retire. And so what will happen then on abortion rights? And at the state level, what that means is social conservatives want to push through an abortion ban so that when the Supreme Court moves further to the right, the court case will be primed.
Elizabeth Nash, Senior State Issues Manager at the Guttmacher Institute. Thanks for coming back, Elizabeth.
Thank you for having me.
More on the state of abortion politics and policy. Tomorrow we hear from an anti-abortion rights activist about the fight to overturn Roe and what the future might hold in the Supreme Court.
The decision set us on a course of being one of 4 nations that allows abortion for any reason after fetal viability, ranked with China, North Korea, and Canada. And it set us on an extreme course that is out of sync with public opinion. The decision should be overturned and returned to the American people so the people can decide the issue state by state.
That's tomorrow on The Takeaway. Now to the latest from Washington, where the Senate has a deal to reopen the federal government after a weekend shutdown. It includes an agreement to consider a fix for young undocumented immigrants in the DACA program. Here's how Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer introduced the plan on the Senate floor.
I've been having conversations with the Republican leader over the weekend about a path forward. After several discussions, offers, counteroffers, the Republican leader and I have come to an arrangement. We will vote today to reopen the government, to continue negotiating a global agreement, with the commitment that, if an agreement isn't reached by February the 8th, the Senate will immediately proceed to consideration of legislation dealing with DACA.
Amber Phillips is here. She's a reporter for The Fix from The Washington Post. Hi, Amber.
Hi.
February 8th, says Democratic leader Chuck Schumer. That feels like the can has been officially kicked.
Yep, the can has been officially kicked, which for this Congress counts as a victory. What's interesting about this deal is it really doesn't solve any of the broader problems Congress has that got us into this mess in the first place. You heard Chuck Schumer there say, we will continue negotiating. That means we're going to vote to keep, you know, reopen the government as Democrats in exchange for an agreement from Republicans to keep talking about DACA And then it sounds like there's some sort of verbal agreement that immigration would come up for a vote by the time we could run up against another shutdown if they haven't come to some other kind of deal. It's all a little bit up in the air right now, and I think that's what's remarkable about this moment is the government is reopening without like a firm commitment from either side on what to do next.
So it sounds like Mitch McConnell and the Republicans are willing to say they'll have an honest debate about DACA. Look, there are a lot of senators who want to vote for it. But Amber, where are House Republicans on this? I kind of wonder what good is an agreement in the more moderate Senate to come up with some kind of DACA fix if the House isn't feeling it and if the White House isn't either.
Yeah, I think that is literally the million-dollar question you just asked right there. And it's such a good point because House Republicans, especially some of the conservative members, have considered protecting these young immigrants brought into the country illegally as children as amnesty. You hear Steve King talk about it all the time as amnesty. You hear even in the Senate some Republicans who really have the ears of conservatives and the White House, like Tom Cotton, saying, I don't think this is a good idea unless we get a lot of extractions to restrict legal immigration. So just because the Senate has agreed to start talking about immigration doesn't mean there's a deal that could pass the Senate or the House, let alone both chambers of Congress, and then get to the president, where really nobody in Washington knows what he wants on immigration.
There was a lot of pressure from pro-immigration groups on Democrats before this all got started, Amber, to really force, use a shutdown scenario to force a bill, force an agreement on young undocumented immigrants through the DACA program. It appears that for the moment, at least for the next 3 weeks, Democrats have backed off of that. What led them to back off now? Were they sensing that the politics of a shutdown wasn't playing in their favor?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. I think shutdowns end right when the losing side feels like they've lost public opinion. And I think Democrats, especially knowing they have a lot of Democrats up for election in conservative states, were nervous to have this sort of tagline, Democrats shut down the government and hurt our military, this is Republican tagline, over illegal immigrants. And so felt like their gamble didn't work out for them.
That's Amber Phillips with The Washington Post. Thanks, Amber.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering storage solutions for business, including file folders, banker's boxes, and storage bins for getting organized. More at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, it's pro time. And ACLU, which works nationwide to protect the constitutional rights of all people. ACLU.org. ACLU, we the people.
Larry, you do realize now that we, this group of women you so heartlessly abused over such a long period of time, are now a force, and you are nothing. The tables have turned, Larry. We are here, we have our voices, and we are not going anywhere.
The sentencing phase for the trial of USA Gymnastics doctor Larry Nassar is still going on in Lansing, Michigan. Nassar is charged with a number of sexual crimes. Overall, 140 women and girls have come forward saying that Nassar abused them. We heard from many of them last week on this show. Nassar's almost certain to face additional jail time. He's already been sentenced to 60 years in federal prison for child pornography charges. But now the question of what USA Gymnastics knew about the abuse of athletes looms over that organization. Nassar also practiced medicine in the Michigan State University athletic program. And according to a Detroit News investigation, at least 14 University of Michigan officials were notified of the abuse over the 2 decades during which it occurred. In addition to that, it took USA Gymnastics 5 weeks to report the abuse to the FBI when it first came to their attention. Olympic gold medalist Allie Raceman testified and gave a victim impact statement at the trial on Friday.
It is like being abused all over again. I have represented the United States of America in 2 Olympics and have done so successfully. And both USA Gymnastics and the United States Olympic Committee have been very quick to capitalize and celebrate my success. But did they reach out when I came forward? No.
So athletes at all levels of gymnastics and their parents, not just the elites, are looking for accountability here. Who knew what and when, and will anyone else be held accountable for the decades of abuse? Well, now three executives on the board of the governing body for USA Gymnastics have resigned. USA Gymnastics Board of Directors Chairman Paul Perilla, Vice Chairman Jay Binder, and Treasurer Bitsy Kelly all resigned. Allie Raceman and other gymnasts had called for Paul Perilla to step down. I asked Lindsay Gibbs about all of this. Lindsay is a sports reporter at Think Progress and co-host of the sports and feminism podcast, Burn It All Down. The question, what did Paul Perilla and others know as this abuse was going on?
We don't know exactly what came across Paul Perilla's desk. He staunchly defended the actions of Steve Penny, who was the CEO and president of USA Gymnastics during this time. Steve Penny was forced to resign with a $1 million severance package last March due to his mishandling of this.
Lindsay, the Indy Star, about a year ago in March, published 5,600 pages of reports suggesting hundreds of complaints against dozens of coaches, many of whom weren't banned from the sport for years and were later convicted of crimes against children.
Of course, Larry Nassar deserves all the condemnation and all the attention he's getting, but we also need to remember that this is a systemic issue within USA Gymnastics that goes far beyond Larry Nassar.
Let's talk about Michigan State University, where Larry Nassar worked as a sports medicine doctor. Reports have come out suggesting as many as 14 adults were informed of Nassar's abuse over the years, but that for years nothing was done. What do we know about who knew what and when within the MSU system?
Well, we certainly know that Kathy Glagas, who was the head coach of the women's gymnastics team up until just last year when she was allowed to resign, once again was not fired, but was allowed to resign. We know that she was told in 1997 that Larry Nassar was inappropriately touching these gymnasts. And at that time, she talked to the gymnast who had brought the complaint forward and said that if they went forward with this complaint, it would bring great consequences to the gymnast who was reporting it. And she reiterated that what Larry Nassar was doing was a legitimate medical procedure. And that was that. We know that the allegations stopped with her. We know that in 1999 and 2000, trainers amongst MSU athletics. It's important to remember that Larry Nassar did not just treat gymnasts. He was a sports medicine doctor at Michigan State University. So he saw athletes from across disciplines, as well as people who weren't associated with Michigan State at all, who just came to him because he was the best. But we know that a softball player in 1999 came forward and told her trainers about the abuse. And as far as we know, the allegations just went nowhere. They were not properly reported. They did not properly go up the food chain, and they were not investigated. They simply were not taken seriously.
What about Luann Simon, the president of Michigan State University, and people below her?
We know that in 2014, there was a Title IX investigation and a police investigation into Larry Nassar's abuse. And Simon knew that that Title IX investigation was going on. That Title IX investigation was incredibly sloppy. It involved the Title IX investigator talking to friends of Larry Nassar's to decide whether or not this was a legitimate medical procedure. It involved them leaving out key details that they found in their report. And as far as we know, because this Title IX investigation, after just a couple of months, cleared Larry Nassar and allowed him to go back to work, Lou Anna Simon never looked back into this, never followed up on this, and never took the time to figure out what was going on. And those below her, the deans in the medical department, other athletic trainers within Michigan State University, and other doctors who worked alongside Larry Nassar, all knew that this was going on, and nobody took action.
There was an op-ed in the New York Times, Lindsay, calling on the U.S. Olympic Committee to basically dissolve its relationship with USA Gymnastics, make it no longer the sanctioning body for Olympic athletes. Is that likely to happen? What has USA Gymnastics said?
It would be a big step if that happened, but there is a big call among the victims and among advocates for U.S. Olympic Committee to actually step up and do something. Allie Raceman and her wonderful testimony and heartbreaking testimony on Friday, she said something that really stuck with me, which was that the U.S. Olympic Committee has always been willing to capitalize on her success, but that they have not once reached out to her since she came out as a victim of abuse. And there was no representative from the U.S. Olympic Committee at the hearing last week listening to all of these victim impact statements. U.S. Olympic Committee could decertify USA Gymnastics. It could take away its power, and it could at least threaten to take away its power if there are not systemic changes. The U.S. Olympic Committee did pressure Steve Penny to resign, but there has been no pressure for there to be any other changes on the board of directors, and the entire board of directors is the same.
Meanwhile, Lindsay, Larry Nassar is going to jail probably for the rest of his life. Do you think anybody else will?
That's what remains to be seen. The next steps are figuring out who else needs to be held accountable, not just on a moral level, but perhaps on a criminal one as well.
Lindsay Gibbs with Think Progress, co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast. Lindsay, thanks for coming back.
Thank you for having me.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Babbel, a language app that teaches real-life conversations in a new language like Spanish, French, and German. Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons are available in the App Store or online at Babbel, Babbel.com.
America is looking back on 1 year of the Donald Trump presidency now. All this week, we'll look at the tangible effects of that first year in office and how it's affected people's lives. We'll look at things like immigration and the courts and the environment. But let's start with the economy. President Trump has been busy taking credit for low unemployment and a strong stock market. All presidents do that if they get the chance. But how is President Trump actually affecting the economy? How much can any president after only 1 year? And most importantly, what does it all mean for the lives of everyday Americans? Annie Lowry is contributing editor at The Atlantic, and she says with this case of presidential credit, not so fast.
Trump just inherited this kind of great, pretty vigorous, not especially fast or hot, but very long-lasting economic boom. He's had very little effect on the economy. That'll be different 5 years from now because of this tax cut package that they passed, which is legitimately enormous. But those cuts haven't come into place yet. And so even though you see kind of companies gesturing like, oh, we have all this money, we're going to give it to all of these workers, the economy right now has very little to do with Donald Trump.
Right now, I want to talk about that tax cut. It's been the key economic feature of President Trump's term so far, certainly. It's just come into effect. Nobody has seen the tax cuts yet, but corporations are loving it.
Yeah, they are. So first of all, their statutory rates got cut. And what this means is that their effective rates also got cut really significantly. So the actual rate that they pay, not the paper rate, has fallen from an estimated 22% to an estimated 9%. They are going to save hundreds of billions of dollars a year. And there's also a provision in the bill that lets them move money back from overseas. And they're really, really happy about that. That's something that they've wanted for a long time. And they get to do that at a very special rate, a special low rate. You know, it's paired with a massive deregulatory agenda that has really helped a bunch of very specific industries. Extractive industries, for instance, are thrilled with Donald Trump. But that doesn't change the fact that their numbers have not really changed much quite yet. Again, it's going to take a while for those tax cuts to come into effect and for the benefit of the tax cuts to filter down to workers in the way that they will.
What about these employee bonuses from American companies that we've been seeing? I mean, the money is good for people working at these companies. There's no doubt about that. But one view on this, Annie, is that this is kind of photo op economics, like the carrier deal that President Trump got behind earlier last year, designed to make political points, maybe without saying much about the real health of the economy. Is that how you would view it?
Absolutely. So two things have been happening that have forced employers to raise wages. One is that the unemployment rate is very low. And so employers have to compete for workers. They have to bid up against other companies. They've started to do things like take on workers that before, so either, you know, perhaps the long-term unemployed, perhaps people with a criminal record, that before they might have said, you know, we're not even going to look at those applicants. So that's led to wage increases, right? Because, you know, if our employers are fighting over a prospective employee, they might, you know, say, okay, we're going to, you know, add $1,000 extra or something to that person's paycheck. Second thing that happened was a bunch of states and cities have raised their minimum wages really considerably. So just on January 1st, 18 states raised their minimum wages, including some by 85 cents or a dollar. It's pushing about $5 billion additional dollars into workers' pockets. So that's really the two things that are happening that are forcing companies to, especially at the low end, to raise wages. And one of the really interesting things is if you look at the economy right now, wages are actually growing faster in percentage terms for really low-income workers, kind of right down around the minimum wage as opposed to higher-income workers sort of around the middle. And so these really are just probably raises that would have happened otherwise. The other thing is, you know, I know you hear, oh my goodness, it's like six different companies announced it. But if you look economy-wide, this is a much bigger trend that has a lot to do with the economic fundamentals and not very much to do with the Trump tax cuts, at least not yet. And this is just companies taking advantage and, you know, currying favor with the administration and getting a bunch of nice headlines for something that they probably might have done anyway.
Annie Lowry with The Atlantic. Annie, great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Last year, we dared to hope for a better, brighter, more equal and inclusive world. And this year, we're going to go out and build it.
The world is taking notice that women birth babies and revolutions.
The anger is really palpable, especially with the headlines.
Yeah, it represents women's rights and what we need to change about society today.
Sounds from this weekend and the second year of women's marches all around the country. Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's been 1 year since millions of women and men all over the world demonstrated for the Women's March of 2017, protesting the newly inaugurated president and marching for women's issues, including reproductive rights. Professor Dana Fisher of the University of Maryland has surveyed more than 1,000 of the participants in these and other major demonstrations over the course of the last year. Marches are one thing, but practical political action is another. And I asked Dana Fisher if these marches constitute a bona fide political movement.
There's no question in my mind, Todd, that this is, in fact, a political movement at this point. But I just want to stress that it goes beyond just women's rights. Although the Women's March was the spark that ignited the resistance, and it turned out the conservative estimates right now are 1.6 million people this weekend were in the streets marching for the anniversary. But it goes well beyond just women's issues.
How far beyond?
So much so that this weekend, the people who turned out reported to my research team that 78% of them came out because they were motivated by issues of immigration. Over 60% of them were motivated by issues of racial justice. They were motivated by issues of the environment. They were motivated by issues of labor in this country. It really runs the gamut of progressive issues at this point.
So what do we know about how much more politically engaged women and others who are marching have become since the march last year? Not just going to marches and making placards, of course, but really getting engaged in politics in some way.
People are coming out and they're doing much more than just marching and yelling in the streets and making signs, of course. They are contacting elected officials. They are attending town hall meetings. Many of them are contacting the media to express their voices. And what we've seen over the year, so this is now we've been collecting data since last Women's March all the way through this year, through this past weekend, is we're seeing those numbers have been holding steady or even going up. So, for example, contacting an elected official, 61% of the people in the crowd this weekend reported contacting an elected official in the past year specifically to address them about issues that were concerning them.
Now, what does that number tell you and other numbers you have about political engagement? Because there's the problem of the self-selected group, right? The person who's likely to come out in March is the person who's likely to call the member of Congress, and people who don't march maybe are busy with other things.
Oh, very true. But at the same time, the person who comes out and marches is not just marching. They're also making a lot of noise. And they're making a lot of noise in their communities. I mean, one of the things that I think is remarkable about this year's Women's March is the fact that the Women's March was actually mobilized by state and local organizations to bring people out. Last year, there were a lot of national groups that were saying, come to Washington, D.C., come march on the Mall after the inauguration. This year, actually, the march in D.C. was coordinated by a bunch of local groups working in Virginia, in fact. But still, people came. They persisted and they resisted. But what I think it really tells us is that those people may very well self-select into being more active, but more people are self-selecting into being active than ever before.
61% of people who you talk to are calling their member of Congress. Some numbers. What else did you find?
Here's a very interesting one. 11% of the people who came out this weekend self-identify as moderates, and 4% identify as politically to the right or right-leaning. That's really interesting in contrast to last year, where at the Women's March in 2017, only 6% identified as being moderate, 1% identified as being to the right. So we're now at 15% of the people in the streets were actually moderates or right-leaning, which is really interesting and shows the ways that the resistance is expanding in really interesting ways that are important to politics and certainly important to the midterm elections.
There have been a couple of special elections and off-year elections last year, Virginia, Alabama. What did those hard numbers at the polls tell you?
The hard numbers at the polls tell us that there are people who are supporting the more progressive candidates. They're coming out, and they're coming out quite substantially. I mean, Democrats historically tend not to participate in midterm elections as much as Republicans do. But I don't think that that's what we're seeing. Even with the poll numbers that came out this weekend, with regard to how the Democrats might do this coming fall, I think that given what we're seeing with regard to people participating in the streets and with all of the different special elections that have happened, there's no question that there is a blue wave coming. The question is, how far will the wave go? And to me, the other question is, if the blue wave is successful, what happens to the resistance?
And, you know, Dana, there have been reports from the political parties and from early primaries around the country, early races shaping up, that there's a large number of women throwing down and running for office. What can you tell us about that?
There are a number of organizations that have emerged trying to get what we would consider, I guess, non-traditional, as silly as that might seem, non-traditional candidates onto ballots, helping to get women to run for office, getting scientists to run for office, getting people of color to run for office. All of those organizations are extremely busy, and we will see a very different slew or cohort of people running for office in primaries this year. I think one of the things that I hope will come out of this movement and this time in America's history is that people, there's no question they're starting to pay attention, but they need to pay attention to the primary period as well, because primaries are where a lot of the big decisions about policy directions are made.
I know quite a few people in my own life, Dana, who always voted, I suppose, but were never really engaged in politics. Not all of them liberal, by the way, who are now engaged in the local political party one way or the other, in some cases marching one way or the other, certainly calling members of Congress. You see it a lot, just anecdotally.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the other thing that, I mean, one of the measures that we use as social scientists when we are interested in civic engagement and political participation is talking about politics at the dinner table. And this is something that I have people frequently from all walks of life, including my husband's colleague, who said to me, my kids, for the first time ever, actually want to talk about politics at the dinner table. You know, people are engaged. I mean, how many people in the White House on Capitol Hill can your average person across the country now name and can get a sense of what they stand for and what political issues are being discussed? What's the focus of the shutdown? I think all of these things matter a lot. I mean, and they matter a lot for democracy, and they matter a lot for America. So, I mean, I do study the resistance, but this isn't just about left-leaning politics in America either. This is just about America and America's democracy, I think.
Dana R. Fisher, professor of sociology at the University of Maryland. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Todd.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick. The world is in the middle of the worst refugee crisis since World War II. Historically, the United States has been a destination for those fleeing war or famine or persecution. But the Trump administration has drastically cut the number of refugees who can come to the United States. And that means more refugees than ever before are left to make impossible choices.
I would say that the defining feature of the refugee population is separation. It's separation from the extended family, and in a minority of cases, but not a small minority, it's separation from husband, wife, separation from kids. That includes the loss of a husband or wife or a kid to death.
That's David Miliband, head of the International Rescue Committee, and that kind of separation is at the heart of our next story. The Democratic Republic of Congo has been plagued by civil war and political instability, forcing many Congolese to flee for their lives and many to apply for admission to the United States.
the United States has actually received more refugees from the Democratic Republic of Congo over the last 3 years than any other country. And we never hear about these folks. And they've been greatly affected by the refugee policy changes that the administration has enacted, even though those policies are really aimed at keeping out Muslim terrorists from Muslim-majority countries.
WNYC reporter Matt Katz there. Matt recently spent time reporting a love story spanning two continents and trying to survive overwhelming political forces. It's the story of Congolese refugees Andre Twendeli and Lizette Lukoji.
I met Andre, who actually moved to the U.S. 13 days before Trump was elected. His wife was stuck overseas and now is unable to get here in large part because of changes in refugee policy. So they're able to illustrate for us what happens when you get here and what happens if you can't.
I want to talk about what Andre's life is like here in the United States now, but he spent years, many years, in a refugee camp in Malawi. He's from the Democratic Republic of Congo, as we said. What was life like there for him and for Lizette?
Andre was a law student in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and he was politically involved. He opposed the president, President Kabila, who's still the president today. This was 12 years ago. Kabila has a authoritarian streak, doesn't allow for much civil discourse. But Andre decided to help lead a protest against the president, and he was arrested, beaten, and imprisoned by the president's security forces. He had, though, fortunately become friendly with a guard, and when he and his seven classmates were taken into the woods to be executed, the guard actually pretended to shoot Andre and did not shoot him.
It was very, very bad. People died in my presence. My friends, they died in my presence. It's a long time ago, but I have that image. I remember everything.
Matt, it's an absolutely harrowing story. Of course he still has that image. It'll be with him for the rest of his life.
Absolutely right. And he then had to pick himself up and figure out a way to get out of the country. The neighboring country is Zambia. He thought that was too close. So he went to Malawi, which is two countries away. And from there, he was directed to a refugee camp. He spent 11 years in two different refugee camps in Malawi. No contact with his friends, no contact with his family. His parents died while he was in this refugee camp. He had no idea about it. But he was able to build something of a community, and he ended up meeting a woman there. And her name is Lizette. And she also had a harrowing story of escape from Congo. Her uncle actually opposed President Kabila. One day, President Kabila's forces came to arrest all of her family. She actually had a small child at the time with a man who had gone off to war and never come back. But she was stripped away from her daughter, a two-year-old girl named Lorette. She was put in a prison. She suffered sexual assault and then escaped barefoot. Ended up two countries away, also in Malawi, at this refugee camp. Never saw her daughter again, but she did meet this other refugee named Andre, and they fell in love.
Andre and Lizette are a married couple, Matt. Why is Andre here now as a refugee, and Lizette is still at the refugee camp in Malawi trying to get to the United States?
Before he met Lizette, Andre began the years-long process to try to get to the U.S. The vetting process for refugees is extraordinary. More than any other traveler to the U.S., refugees go through a whole range of security procedures and a massive vetting process. So in 2012, he applies through the U.N. to become a refugee resettled in the West. Then during that process, he met Lizette, but then he finally got approved after they were married. But he never changed his application to indicate that he was married because he thought that would delay his arrival. So when he finally gets the letter saying he can come to the U.S. nearly 4 years after he first applied, this is October 2016, sits down with Lizette and they try to figure out what to do.
She told me that, no, just go. I know that you are my husband, you love me, and you will do your best to help me so I can join you there in USA.
Now they assume that, you know, after 6 months or so, they could apply for Lizette and she'd be able to get to the U.S. just like he had come. But obviously, it was still a gut-wrenching experience.
Everyone cried. But Andre cried much more than me.
because here we live a very complicated life. And he was just thinking about how he was leaving me in this mess, which hurt more.
I mean, these people fell in love and dated and got married in the most unimaginably terrible circumstance, in the middle of a refugee camp where they don't have indoor plumbing or electricity. And yet they found this magical connection with another person, and now they're not able to experience it in real life. So it's really gut-wrenching for both of them.
And Andre hasn't seen Lizette since. I mean, they remain separated. She's trying to get to the United States while he's here in New Jersey.
That's right. 13 days after he arrived, President Trump is elected. President Trump has enacted the most severe cutback to the refugee program that we've seen in a generation. Fewer refugees are coming in than at any time since the 70s. Her arrival, it will be delayed indefinitely.
What's Andre's life like now in New Jersey? What's he doing for work? What does he do day to day?
It's hard, but so much better than it was back at Zuleika refugee camp in Malawi. He works an overnight shift with other refugees at a seafood distributor. They pack fish that becomes sushi at fancy restaurants in Manhattan and beyond. It's tough work, but he makes enough money to have food every day, which was not the case in the refugee camp. And he made enough money to buy Lizette a phone. If he's not at work, if he's not watching soccer back in his apartment with his roommates, then he's on the phone with Lizette. They talk three or four times a day. I went to visit him at the seafood distributor, and during the break in his shift at 4:10 a.m., he was on the phone with Lizette. This is their lifeline.
Matt Katz reporting the five-part series Unsettled for WNYC. Matt, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Todd.
And we'll have more with Matt tomorrow. You can listen to all of Matt's reporting for this project. It's called Unsettled, and you can find it at WNYC.org. And we started this hour looking at the abortion fight in America, 45 years after Roe versus Wade. We'll have more voices on this American debate, including yours.
This is Jeremy from Dallas. I believe women should have the right to do whatever they desire to their own body. But abortion isn't about a woman's right over her body. It's about a woman's right to kill her child. And I don't support that right. I never will.
I'm calling from New York. In my own life, I have four children. I've had three abortions. None of them were easy. They were all the right thing to do. And I was always using birth control. So what are you going to do?
Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can always tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for being with us today. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Babbel, a language app that teaches real-life conversations in a new language like Spanish, French, and German. Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons are available in the App Store or online at Babbel, Babbel.com. And Staples, offering storage solutions for business, including file folders, banker's boxes, and storage bins for getting organized. More at Staples Stores or Staples.com. Staples, it's pro time.
PRI, Public Radio International.